It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up on Central Time, we explore the essentials of good taste through three popular foods. That's ahead in our Food Friday segment.
But first, a look at Wisconsin's tax climate. Some have blamed the state's stagnant economy, slow job growth, on high taxes.
According to a new report released by the financial publication Kiplinger, Wisconsin is actually a medium tax state.
So is Wisconsin really a tax hell? Was it ever? Mike Ivey is with us. He's a business reporter for the Capital Times. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Before we get to the report, this issue, how bad are taxes in Wisconsin, this is one people have been back and forth on for quite a while now, isn't it?
Well, it certainly became an issue in the last governor's race, but I mean, if you go back even to Governor Thompson, it was an issue back in the 90s, so it's still out there.
And one of the arguments that keeps coming back and forth is, does it depend on how we measure? If we're talking about taxes or fees and lumping those in together, it's harder than it would sound to compare us to other states.
Yeah, you need to be careful when you talk about taxes, because if you just talk about straight flat tax rates, states where incomes are higher, the ability to pay is greater in those states. One reason Wisconsin has sort of had that reputation as the tax hell is because our rates weren't particularly so high, but our incomes compared to a lot of states are not that high. So we're sort of middle of the road on incomes, maybe a little higher on the tax end. And as a result, when the Census Bureau does a survey of the total tax burden, we ended up in that top five range for a long time. What's interesting, guys, is that beginning in 2005, Wisconsin started to sort of go the other direction. And by 2007, we actually were out of the top 10 in terms of taxes based on per capita income. So we're now in we ended up, I think, ranked 11th in the last time they did that. So, you know, things have been kind of going in the right direction. If you don't like paying a lot of taxes, nobody likes paying taxes.
So there's this Kiplinger report now that you wrote about. What did they find about Wisconsin compared to the rest of the country?
They didn't put a number on it, but we were not in the top 10. And if you go to our website, captimes.com, you can see I've got a lot of the data up there, and we're in that white sort of mixed category, and they've got a map up of all the states, but you can see Minnesota, least tax friendly, Illinois, least tax friendly. We're in the white with Iowa and Michigan, called mixed. And then, of course, you've got the most tax friendly states, and these would be states that don't have any personal income tax, like Texas and Florida and Nevada, and some states don't even have a sales tax, states that do enough, raise the money other ways.
And how up to date are these? Do they get the most recent property tax cuts?
Kiplinger, even if you read the report, it talks about the income tax cuts that were passed as part of the last budget. It didn't talk about this last little tiny property tax cut they did. But property taxes are really a good issue. I think one reason people in Wisconsin get so worked up over taxes is we use the property tax to fund so much of our schools and local government, and that's that bill you get every year in December, and it looks like a big number versus your income tax, which is, you know, taken out of your check as you go along. So Wisconsin, more than other states, does rely on that property tax to fund schools and government, and then you end up with that bill. So I think that really works people up.
What have you heard as far as reaction from this new report?
I'm just reading off the comment board, which is sort of how we measure a lot of public reaction nowadays. And, you know, you end up with the usual back and forth. A lot of people think that, or make the argument that, yes, paying taxes is what gives us good schools and good services here. And there was a real good comment on my story from somebody who said, you know, for a long time, Wisconsin sort of went along and people paid taxes and we all seemed to get along and had decent schools and a high quality of life, and it's only become the past. I think the recession brought a lot of the discussion on, too. You know, when everybody feels tight on cash, then taxes have become a bigger issue.
And how about official reaction or groups like the Taxpayers Alliance? What do they make of these things?
Taxpayers Alliance, they were the ones that pointed out that you can't just look at rates like Kiplinger was doing in its report. And they do their own analysis. Again, that's linked on our story here. And they've got Wisconsin 11th highest in the country on what they call total tax burden. Again, that's looking at fees, taxes, weighed against per capita income.
So extending out to the argument here, tax-friendly, tax-unfriendly, however you want to define states, does that then necessarily mean business-friendly or business-unfriendly?
Well, you know, the other numbers that I've seen out there, usually coming from business groups, they've still got Wisconsin in the pretty unfriendly business category. But I think it's important to remember that the first budget under Walker, this would have been the 2011-2012 budget, it removed income taxes for factory owners and farm owners. So if you're involved in a manufacturing or an ag business, you are no longer paying any income tax in Wisconsin under something called the Manufacturing and Ag Tax Credit. That kicks in 2014, and that's probably the most significant tax change Wisconsin has made in decades. And the argument was we need to encourage the so-called job creators by eliminating their tax burden. And WMC, the Wisconsin Manufacturing Commerce, had been pushing for this for several years. When it finally was included in the budget 3 years ago, it was hailed as the biggest change ever. Now, whether that is going to suddenly cause companies to move here or expand, I guess that remains to be seen.
Mike, as an eagle-eyed reporter, you may be aware there's an election for governor coming up next year. Do you see people looking at numbers like this and trying to figure out how they play into the spin in the year ahead?
Oh, I'm sure taxes will get batted about. The line from the governor will probably be, do we want to go back to the tax and spend policies of the previous administration? I don't know what Mary Burke's going to say on taxes. She's you know, talked about being business friendly and comes from a business background as well, but it's going to be one of the issues out there. I don't think it'll be the main issue. I think people are still going to, you know, hold the governor to his 250,000 jobs pledge. There've been some signs that the job creation is ticking up here a little bit. I think the announcement that Amazon wants to build a large distribution center in Kenosha, I think that's a big issue. That may have something to do with the fact that they won't having. I don't think they'll be paying taxes on that facility, if I'm reading everything correctly.
And you mentioned in your piece, I think, the previous administration, the Doyle administration, said there was some movement on some of these tax ratings even then.
Say what you want about past Governor Doyle, but I don't think he got the credit that he probably deserved for making a lot of those tough decisions that Walker talks about. But think back, I mean, Doyle had a hiring freeze on. He had vowed to cut 10,000 jobs. He instituted the furloughs. He did a lot of that sort of stuff to try and rein in spending that he didn't get much credit for. But if you look at when Wisconsin really started to move out of that top five taxing states, it was under Doyle. So I think there's some irony there.
All right, Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Mike Ivey, business reporter for the Capital Times.
Up next, discover a few foods essential to great taste, according to our Food Friday guest.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Time now for Food Friday. Our next guest has written a guide about the 50 foods he thinks every modern gourmet must know, with an emphasis on tradition and simplicity.
He says knowing good food is part of a complete understanding of the world, and it's necessary for living a good life.
Joining us now is Ed Baer. He's the founder of The Art of Eating and the author of 50 Foods, The Essentials of Good Taste. Ed, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, you said that knowing good food is part of a complete understanding of the world. It's necessary for good life. Why?
Why? Oh, boy, put me on the spot. I think, you know, good food, eating deliciousness is about sensuality. And I think that's a part of life that maybe the Puritans up here in New England haven't always embraced, but I think it's important. You don't really understand the natural world, for instance, without a feeling for the senses, and food is a huge part of our experience of the senses.
Well, this new book of yours, it looks at the top 50 foods. Well, not top 50, but the 50 that you feel are essential. How did you pick these?
Well, you know, everybody wants me to say that they're the best foods or my absolute favorite foods. But if I just chose those, there might not have been any balance. I mean, I don't know. I love cheese, so maybe there'd be 49 cheeses plus butter or something, which is perfect.
That would sell in Wisconsin. Yeah.
We're in dairy states. So they're foods that I love, but I wanted to have, you know, I wanted to have lettuce. I wanted to have green beans. I wanted to have beef. I wanted to have caviar and a few unusual things. I wanted chocolate. So I love all those foods, but there is a bit of a distribution.
And as part of this, that, you know, these are often kind of foundational foods. You know, for instance, we'll be talking about eggs today, and eggs go into lots of other yummy dishes, desserts and custards and omelets and souffles and all that kind of thing.
For sure. No, they're kind of, I mean, as I've written about it, they're really, they're architecture. They're the foundations for so many other things, and they're delicious in themselves. And they produce so many textures, really luscious textures sometimes.
Well, we picked three to talk about. We couldn't possibly cover all 50, but I think we picked three good ones. We've got beef and eggs and chocolate. Let's start with beef, because that's something that Americans have been eating for a long time. What do we need to know about beef?
Well, beef, the bad news for me, from my perspective, is that the beef in supermarkets has been going downhill a bit over time. Cattle are slaughtered younger, less care is taken all along the way. The good news is that, of course, meanwhile, at farmers' markets and at different other sort of less mainstream stores, the quality of meat in general, and is certainly led by beef, has been going up, so that there's really delicious, flavorful beef out there. And for me, yes, you can have really delicious, totally lean beef, but for me, and I think most Americans, the beefiest taste has some kind of a balance between fat and lean, between flavorful fat, and sometimes we hear that, I don't know, all the flavor in meat is in the fat, but that's not true. There's also very flavorful meat, especially when the cattle have been raised partly out on pasture and outdoors, so you get really flavorful so-called, you know, free-range cattle. Range is, of course, the key word in the past.
Right. Well, and there has been some debate over what cattle should eat for the most flavorful beef. And, you know, it seems as though the trend had been to feed cattle, you know, corn or sometimes grain and not grass. Where do you come down on the grass, corn?
A little bit in the middle. Certainly you want a lot of grass, and the corn feeding isn't even all that old. I mean, it's decades old, but it's not sort of the primordial way of raising cattle. And as my position, and it's not perhaps the most scientific one, but is that a certain amount of corn isn't so harmful for cattle, and so finishing cattle on corn isn't up to a point, isn't all that bad. But you can finish cattle and get a very rich marbled meat on grass. It just has to be really rich grass.
How do you have rich grass?
You have rich grass. You have to, it has to be the right time of year. You have to live in a climate that has good rainfall, and Wisconsin would qualify. You have to have a well-managed pasture, for instance, because I'm more familiar with pasture being here in the east, that is allowed to regrow. I mean, if you just let the pasture be untended, tall grasses aren't so good. You want them at a certain height. They're, at that point, they're the richest in nutrition, that sort of thing.
It's interesting to me that in France, it sounds like, where you consider sort of beef central, they really know how to produce good beef, the cattle aren't slaughtered till they're five, some of them, or 7 years old.
Well,
and here,
that's more historical than good economics for the present. I was really talking about a prime point of reference.
Ideally, we would be able to do this.
I mean, something over 20 months. There's no firm age. It depends, of course, on the flavor depends a lot on breed. It depends upon the way it's raised. I don't know, even time of year, diet, of course, as we've been talking about. So there are multiple factors, but it takes a certain amount of time for a plant to accumulate flavor and also for an animal.
Now, at the end of each entry, you give sort of suggestions about how to prepare the ingredient and what goes well with it in terms of wine and complementary ingredients. What do you suggest with beef?
Oh, boy, all kinds of things. Now you scare me that I'll contradict what I've written, but I'm a big fan of anything onion. Roasted onions are good. Roasted root vegetables, very good at this time of year. If you go in a completely different direction, you know, you could have a béarnaise sauce with tarragon. Cognac, even in the sauce, kind of enriches it, going in an extreme there. But there are all kinds of other things, and, you know, they don't have to be rich and heavy. They're, you know, a lettuce leaf under a grilled steak is super classic and super good.
All right, well, let's move on to something especially yummy, timely with all of us eating candy for leftover from Halloween, chocolate. What comes to your mind when you think about what makes truly excellent chocolate?
Well, it's kind of that there are almost two kinds of chocolate in the world at the risk of oversimplification. One is the chocolate almost every one of us, probably every one of us, grew up on, which are familiar names that we won't mention here at the moment. And there's nothing wrong with them, and they make people happy. But there's a kind of a second sort of chocolate, and it really has to do with the quality of the beans and the trees they come from, that has much more fruit flavor, even floral flavors you can find in it. So those combined with roasting flavors and bitterness to create a full chocolate flavor. And those, for me, are more interesting, especially the fruit and flower components. I mean, people talk about chocolate almost the way they talk about wine, and maybe it's a little tedious. But, you know, cherries, different things, you know, orange, different things that people think they taste in that chocolate. And for me, that's a much more interesting experience.
Now, you're talking mostly about dark chocolate here, which it sounds like is your partial to. It sounds like you don't really want to waste your time with milk chocolate.
No, it's kind of true.
And I won't even get you started on white chocolate. But
yeah, no, I think I wrote that was one of, in the whole book, I think that was one of the, almost the only things that I just say are abominable. But, you know, perhaps it's a matter of taste.
All right, well, you talk about a process for chocolate that I was unaware of, conching. And apparently it's, you know, not controversial, but it's a choice chocolatiers make about whether to conch or not to conch. Can you tell us what that is?
That's true. In times, years past, in Europe, for instance, it's very typical to conch it. It's a refining process, and they don't even completely understand what goes on. But it's textural. It has to do with flavor, and they used to conch for even several days. Now it's a matter of hours, and there's some, you know, very fancy chocolates that will even tell you just how long they were conched. A chocolatier that I talked to, who's in Massachusetts, says that when he conches and he goes home at the end of the day, his wife can smell just how strong it is because there are off flavors that come out. And what this process is, it's a machine. The original one was shaped like a shell, thus conch, conch. And it just basically turns the chocolate over and over. It's just constantly keeping it in motion. And that goes on for, as I say, hours and perhaps occasionally still a few days.
Interesting. Okay, well, we got to get to eggs, but last question. You say chocolate kills wine. So what do you do if you want to have chocolate and wine?
What you do? Well, you could go for more alcoholic beverages, meaning, you know, certain fortified wines, and also particularly not a great Bordeaux, but something with strong, intense flavors, and they're oxidized wines. For instance, certain strong, sweet sherries that have been aged for a time, not necessarily expensive. And then there's a wine that I especially like called Banyuls from the south of France in the Mediterranean just by the French border, and another one from the same place called Mauris. And you can get a Mauris that's not too expensive. And those can have just their sweet flavors. Somehow there's enough alcohol and sugar to stand up to the chocolate and enough intensity of flavor, and you get some really special combinations with chocolate.
But in general, you've got a really expensive wine. Don't waste it with your chocolate.
That's really true.
Okay, so what about eggs? You know, obviously fresh is good, right? Should you go for the freshest egg you can find?
Yes, I would say without doubt, except for the notion that a super fresh egg is harder to peel if you want a peeled boiled egg.
And are you partial to the different eggs? I don't know. Since I've been frequenting farmers' markets more frequently, and they're so beautiful, some of these eggs, and the pastel hues. They look like little pastels from Impressionists or something. Do you have a favorite kind of egg?
No, you know, I don't. I have to say I don't think that more beautiful eggs necessarily taste better, although I used to always get blue ones, and they were really wonderful, and I began to associate the blueness with better taste. But I think the science is that it's much more the way the chickens are raised, whether they're outdoors, whether the eggs are fresh, what they're fed, that makes much more difference than the breed, like, you know, Rhode Island Red or one of these fine old familiar names.
In our last 20 seconds or so, what is your favorite thing to do with eggs?
Oh, gosh, I think a souffle. I think just because everyone else says they fall so easily and I can make them rise without trouble. I just like to make souffles.
Wow. I wish we could make you come here and prove that. That sounds fantastic. Well, Ed, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
We've been talking to Ed Baer, the author of 50 Foods, The Essentials of Good Taste.
You're listening to Central Time. Rob Ferret here with Veronica Rickert. This weekend is the fourth Tales from Planet Earth Film Festival. It's an every-other-year celebration of environmental filmmaking, usually around a central theme. It's put on by the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the UW-Madison. This year's theme is Futures. Here to fill us in on what to expect this year is Peter Boger, the Tales from the Planet Earth a festival programmer. And we've got a filmmaker here, too, Peter Gallison, co-director of Containment, one of the films that will be featured in this year's festival. Peter Boger, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Peter Gallison, thanks to you as well.
Pleasure to be here.
Peter Boger, first, tell us, what is the Tales from Planet Earth Film Festival? What are you trying to accomplish?
Well, the goal with Tales from Planet Earth, there are a lot of environmental film festivals out there, but we really wanted to try to expand people's understanding and ideas about what an environmental film is. People tend to think of Planet Earth and those kind of Discovery Channel films, or else they tend to think of diatribe films that tell you that we're all going to die and it's all of our faults. And we really wanted it to be more, no, the environment is where we live, work, and play. And so an environmental film is any film that really explores how people and place relate to each other. And so every festival, that's what we try to accomplish.
Right. I think there might be a note of panic in someone about to sit down and think, am I about to watch a PowerPoint presentation for an hour and a half on a big screen? There's more creativity going on than
that. Absolutely. We want to expand genres. We want people to realize that comedies, that science fiction, that animated films, all of that can be an environmental film as long as you're really exploring how people and place shape each other.
And it's not just, as you said, documentaries.
No, we have lots of fiction films. We have three new science fiction films, anime films. We do have some documentaries going all the way back to 1929. But we also have midnight showings of the original Planet of the Apes or the Mad Max films with Mel Gibson.
Hopefully not visions of things to come in either of those two movies, I hope. So this year's theme, Futures.
Futures. So this really came out of an understanding that we're at this moment now where time is so important to thinking about environmental questions, that we're in an era where everything is moving more rapidly, where there's not a 24-hour news cycle, there's a one-minute news cycle with Twitter and with Facebook. And when you have political discussions and economic discussions working on those timescales, and yet you have environmental crises that develop over decades and over centuries, the two don't match up. And so thinking about futures, it's thinking about time and thinking about how do we tell new stories and how do we think differently about time if we're going to solve these environmental problems that will take generations to solve.
Well, it's a good time to bring you in, Peter Gallison, because your work deals with the time frame of very long half-lives. Your documentary's Containment. Tell us about it.
Well, with my colleague Rob Moss, we've made a film that goes back and forth between the present, where we are trying to dispose of vast amounts of nuclear waste that are the legacy of more than half a century of nuclear weapons production and nuclear power. And looking forward, we have to figure out a way to contain these wastes, to seal them off from the world into which we have contact. So this means you have to ask questions that are both necessary and almost impossible. We have things like plutonium, which have a half-life of 24,000 years. And so right away, you can see that you have to keep these sealed off from us humans for a time much longer than human history. And that back and forth between imagining an unimaginably far future and the current realities of figuring out what we're going to do with this stuff, which we have to do, is the subject of our film.
Let's bounce back and forth between those timescales for a bit. Right, you spent a lot of time on this in New Mexico. Am I right?
That's right. In New Mexico, the only licensed operating nuclear disposal facility exists, an underground facility in a huge salt bed that was laid down several hundred million years ago, is being used to receive the waste that was produced in the course of making about 70,000 nuclear weapons over the course from the time of Hiroshima and Nagasaki to the present. And so we've been filming down there. It's quite an amazing environment. It's about a half a mile underground. And people are emplacing canisters of waste in there, hoping, the idea is that over the course of time, the salt actually compresses. It flows like a slow-moving paste. And under the pressure of being that far underground, it will the idea is that it will seal up those wastes and keep them from access to the environment.
Now, this is not a highly populated area, but it is not a completely depopulated area. What is it like living in the world's only registered nuclear containment area?
Well, for the people that live right near there, the WIP site, the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, is actually a source of great pride and jobs. There are about 1,000 jobs that each pay about $100,000 with benefits. So this is in a not rich part of the country where this has become a major source of employment, and technically it's worked out pretty well. It's not collapsing. They haven't had big failures or problems with it. So people there are quite proud of it. In the nearby town of Carlsbad and the surrounding towns near there, you may have heard of Carlsbad Caverns, but this is not far from there. It's in the southeastern part of New Mexico. Now, in the north of New Mexico, people have been quite opposed to this site. So even within a single state, it's been a contentious issue. But locally, the WIP site has the support and participation of the community now.
Now let's look toward the future time frame you mentioned. In addition to wanting to safely physically contain this stuff, is there a question of how, in case people stumble onto this in the future, archaeologists, miners, how do we convey to people who might not speak English or any current language on the earth maybe, this is bad stuff, stay out?
Well, that's the problem. And when Congress approved the idea of making the waste repository in New Mexico, they put a constraint on it. They said, you have to be able to mark for 10,000 years. Now, 10,000 years is not even half of one half-life of plutonium. So the question was, why choose that? Well, they thought, if you could convey things to 10,000 years in the future, then like a relay race, they'd carry it on forward. But in order to figure out how to mark the site, how to build the kind of monuments that would be interpretable to the very far distant future, they had to imagine what kind of inadvertent intrusion might take place. Who might actually dig in there? Well, people might be digging for oil, or they might be digging for water, or for something we don't even know. So how do you communicate to them? So they called in the futurists. This was a profession that was established really at the beginning inside World War II, when the sudden creation of these new technologies of jets and cruise missiles and intercontinental missiles, I mean, large-scale ballistic missiles, became a reality. Suddenly the Air Force and in the years after World War II began to try to imagine what the future would be. And then big companies did too, oil companies and others. So they engaged a new group of people, engineers and other people from other specialties, to try to imagine what they called scenarios, which they referred to almost like little movie scripts, perfectly enough for making a film about it. And they would be stories, little stories that would capture, almost like a war game, little stories that would focus our attention on the kinds of motivations that might lead people to penetrate the site. So when they did that, they began to imagine 100 years in the future, 1,000 years in the future, 5,000 years in the future, 10,000 years in the future. This for an interdisciplinary group that had never imagined farther than 10 or 15 or 20 or 25 years in the future at the outside limit. So it became what I think of as a kind of state science fiction. In fact, there was a science fiction writer who was part of the group, who was also a very good astrophysicist.
All right. Well, Peter Gallison, I'll ask you some more about storytelling and how you tell your story. But Peter Boger, I want to ask you, this is Containment. We've just been talking about that, one of the documentaries at this film festival. Tell us about one or two of the other documentaries that are part of this year's event.
So we have documentaries in several different what we call strands of films. And one of our biggest strands of films, which Containment sits in, is what we call Watts Ahead. So it's about the future of energy, considering different energy sources like nuclear power, also considering the future of the electrical grid. So on Sunday, for example, we're showing two films with filmmakers who are here in Madison, one from India, one from the United Kingdom, who are making films about the lack of access to electricity and the fact that 1.5 billion people around the planet lack regular access to electricity. So one of those films is called Blackout, and it's set in Guinea in West Africa, where only 20% of the country has access to electricity. And Eva Weber, the director who will be there, was there and noticed that there were kids walking down the streets at night and wondered, who are these kids? What are they doing? It turns out they're going to study, and they're going to study at the local gas station because that's the only place that has artificial light. So along with that, there's a film called Powerless by Deepti Kakkar, who will be here, and that's set in India and looking at the same issue of there being a lack of regular electricity for 400 million people in India.
Now, when somebody first described the film festival, the word dystopia was mentioned. Are there dystopian visions in some of the documentaries or fiction films?
We have, each time we've done the festival, we've been fortunate enough to have an interdisciplinary arts institute artist in residence. And this year we have filmmaker Alex Rivera in residence, who made the 2009 Sundance Award-winning film Sleep Dealer. And he's teaching a course here at UW this semester for UW undergrads and graduate students called From Eco-Utopia to Eco-Apocalypse. And each of the students in the class has made a 3-minute short film, and those will be shown in front of every film in the festival.
That's Peter Boger. He's programmer for the Tales from Planet Earth Film Festival. The Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at UW-Madison is behind that. We also have Peter Gallison with us, co-director of a documentary showing at the festival. It's called Containment. This year's theme is futures. We're finding out what to expect, and we'll hear more about how to tell environmental stories on film, whether documentary or fictional format. We'll continue our discussion after this break. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Thanks, Kristen. You're listening to Central Time. We're talking with Peter Boger. He's programmer for the Tales from Planet Earth Film Festival. It's this weekend, UW-Madison. Also with us, Peter Gallison, co-director of Containment, a documentary that will be featured in this year's festival. Well, let's talk a little bit about environmental storytelling. Peter Gallison first. I had mentioned, I joked a little bit earlier, like people might expect a big a PowerPoint presentation writ large. How do you tell an environmental story in a way that makes it as compelling as any other story?
Well, we have a couple of different kinds of stories in this film. They're the sites that really concern nuclear waste. One of them is Fukushima, which has become an enormous waste site now, with cesium-137 strewn over a very wide area, pumped into the sea, in the soil itself. People are trying to figure out how to handle that. Then there's the Savannah River site, a place where we're telling the story of a site where a good amount of the material used in making nuclear weapons during the Cold War left a very large area contaminated, and now it's a huge cleanup site that's going to cost many tens of billions of dollars to sort out. And then there's this New Mexican mine, a salt mine, about a half mile underground, where the waste is being emplaced that comes from the nuclear weapons cleanup effort. So part of the storytelling is about these sites and about also the people that live near them and how they see the world, what it's like to be a person who, say, had to move from near the plant at Fukushima and was trying to come back to their home, or what it's like to be a cattle farmer who's refused to leave in Fukushima and what choices that left him. So they're individual stories in the here and now, as well as the stories of those sites. And finally, there are these stories, these little scenarios, trying to project the future, trying to imagine what might lead people 1,000 or 10,000 years from now to dig into these sites. And those little scripts form the basis for a series of animated explorations that we do of the far distant future.
Wow, you're covering a lot of ground.
Well, what we hope is that this diversity of imagery and the tone, that this fantastically far future and what we might imagine from it, beating against the very material, very real circumstance of people now, actually creates something of an awareness about time of our human present lives, but with dealing with a material and a problem that really engages us with responsibilities towards 400 or 4,000 generations in the future.
And then, Peter Boger, looking at the films on this year's program, environmental films, a lot of them will have a message, mm-hmm. I'm assuming. How do the filmmakers in the festival this year weigh you know, telling their message versus maybe losing the story, losing the narrative? How do they balance those?
Well, I think we try to select for those who are always going to start with story. The motto for the festival is issues don't move people, stories do. And it doesn't always have to be a narrative. It can also be a character. And as the other Peter was pointing out, the landscape itself can actually be that character. It doesn't just have to be a human character. But I think we always want to start with films that aren't just earnest, that aren't just about an issue, but that start with having a strong character or a strong story. Because if you start to care about a person or you start to care about the arc of a story, you then naturally get caught up in the message that's being presented.
So you gave us a taste of some of the documentaries, and Peter Gallison talked about his. Now let's turn to the non-documentaries, the stories, the fictional stories. What are a couple that are highlighted here at the festival?
Well, one of the ones we're really excited about won the Best Animated Feature Award at a recent animated film festival is a film from Brazil called Rio 2096, A Story of Love and Fury. And it's an epic film told over 500 years of Brazil's past and an imagined 100 years of Brazil's future. And it imagines this indigenous character who is the chosen one, who is going to be reborn over several generations, trying to fight against the negative influences of the European colonization on the local environment. And it so goes through many key eras in Brazil's past, including a peasant revolt against the military dictatorship in the 1960s. And then it imagines that out into the future and imagines that the future arguments in 2096 are going to be over access to environmental resources like water.
And this isn't, I think I saw somewhere, this is not viewed as a meat market for distributors to meet filmmakers and make those deals that might happen at Sundance or something like that.
This is a chance, a community meat market, in the sense that we're not trying to sell the film, but we really think this is a valuable opportunity for filmmakers like Peter to come and meet with academics, although Peter is also an academic, who work on these issues here at UW, and also meet with community groups here in Madison, in the Dane County, and all of Wisconsin, who we've tried to bring together and say this is a chance for filmmakers to talk with people working in the field and people working in the academy on these issues and coming together around stories and using stories as the way to catalyze new conversations.
One thing I don't think we've really mentioned yet is climate change and global warming, a fairly big issue for the Nelson Institute, I gather. Are there films that tackle that in this year's festival?
There are. There's, again, this. Actually, it's a pairing of one fiction film and one documentary film. The fiction film is called Promised Land and imagines that in the future, climate change refugees, which is our problem now, will actually be refugees through time, and that people will come backwards from an even worse environmental future into our horrible environmental present, and that bounty hunters will be assigned to try to track down these refugees and prevent them from coming into our time period. And that's paired with a documentary called The Weather War, by two Swedish artists who are interested in the fact that people throughout history have tried to control the weather and what does that mean for us in this era of climate change.
Peter Gallison, what is the state, do you think, of environmental filmmaking now? Do you have thoughts on things you're excited about, trends, other works that that interest you?
Well, I'd say in general what interests me are films, quite consistent with the philosophy of this festival, that are not hectoring, that are not telling people what to think, but inviting them in to a space and a conversation and a story, new forms of visualization. How do you imagine the land or the future of weather or the future of the climate? And I think this is absolutely as true for Rob Moss as it is for me. Our goal in making films, our last was a film called Secrecy, about national security, secrecy, and democracy. And we want to help launch a national conversation about things that can too easily be pushed aside, and not to berate people or make fun of people for not thinking what we think they should think, and instead representing people, whether anyone that appears in a film that we do, should recognize their position as being what they believe and what they're trying to say. And even if they disagree quite violently with other people in the film, it shouldn't be the case that people feel themselves to be parodied or in some way mocked for the views that they hold. So I think environmental documentaries, like other documentaries, really need to in addition to being able to tell stories and to be visually engaging, they need to also invite people in and have a certain respect for an audience.
So start conversations rather than, I guess, finish them.
Yes.
So, Peter Boger, does that fit in with a lot of the films you've got, or the mission of the festival in general, too, I guess?
Absolutely. I know one of our films that's considered by some groups to be controversial is this film called Pandora's Promise, made by UW alum Robert Stone. And it's a film that looks at environmentalists who used to be firmly anti-nuclear power, who've decided that nuclear power is actually potentially part of the solution when we're in this era of climate change and the alternative is carbon-based fuels. And we've had all sorts of people say, how dare you show this film? Isn't this propaganda? And we said, no. If we only show films that we agree with or that everybody who's quote-unquote an environmentalist agrees with, then we're not having a conversation. And so how do we start the dialogue? How do we bring people in who wouldn't think of themselves as, I'm an environmentalist, and get them at an environmental film festival?
One of the things that strikes me about documentary these days is it is a common space for us. It's a kind of a shared experience that we can have. Of course, people, you can stream films and see them individually, but we still have in our culture the sense of getting together in a theater and having a conversation get launched by films. Whereas, you know, a generation ago, that might have been one of the more influential television programs or the standard newspapers that are newspapers of record. Documentary film has become a place where people can go to as a common reference point in their conversation.
Peter Boger, is there a space for conversation at the festival? Do people get together and talk about these things they just saw?
Absolutely. One of our big goals with bringing in filmmakers is to have spaces after as many films as possible to have dialogues with the filmmakers. We also have panels after several of our films where we really try to bring in experts, not just from the university, but from the community, and make this a living film festival, knowing and hoping that the conversations will continue when people leave the theater, when they're in the lobby, and hopefully when they get home.
All right, a last question for each of you. Peter Gallison, as you wrap up Containment, do you have a next project in mind or a dream project that you'd like to do?
Well, it's hard to say. Right now, what we'll be showing is a rough cut. It's nearly finished, but not quite. And it's I can't imagine a more furiously busy time than for a filmmaker to be in these last weeks of making a film. So I can't even imagine my future 6 months from now, let alone 100,000 years from now.
And Peter Boger, anything you're particularly excited about this festival that I didn't give you a chance to talk about yet?
Well, the one thing I would say is in a festival that's about futures, there also needs to be a question of hope and faith for the future. And so we were looking for a film that would have that. And for me, the film is Trash Dance, which we're showing as one of our two closing night films. And it's all about finding hope by finding people coming together as a community, which I think is the perfect embodiment of our festival.
All right. Peter Boger, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Peter Gallison, thank you as well.
Thank you.
That's Peter Boger. He's programmer for the Tales from Planet Earth Film Festival at the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, and Peter Gallison, co-director of the film Containment.